This is the Wisdom Podcast.
The Buddha taught these life practices and inner practices as well to gladden the mind so that you had a more spacious, open, allowing, warm, loving kind of internal environment with which you could meet the suffering. And so that's things like generosity or morality, which make us happier. So we're more buoyant. We're not going into a complex reflection, for example, feeling horrible about ourselves. You know, we're going with a sense of joy that we've made some good choices, and loving kindness fits in there.
Welcome to the Wisdom Podcast. I'm Daniel Aiken. And for this episode, I speak with Sharon Salzberg, world-renowned meditation teacher and practitioner and New York Times best-selling author. Sharon is also co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society, the first ever Western meditation center established in the United States. In this episode, Sharon and I discuss one of her all-time favorite topics, the practice of metta, or loving kindness. Sharon talks about what initially drew her to the practice and its transformational effects over the course of her lifetime. In her down-to-earth style, Sharon explains the practical application of loving kindness in daily life as more than just a concentration practice. Loving kindness can function as an antidote to fear, anxiety, and emotional withdrawal. It can heighten a sense of connection with others, help us to be more assertive, and even transform the most difficult of relationships. She compares loving kindness to what the Buddha taught as gladdening the mind, or ways of cultivating a more loving mental environment in which to navigate the more difficult aspects of life and practice. I hope you enjoy the conversation. What is it about loving kindness that grabbed you, and when did it grab you?
I first heard about it when I first began meditating, which was January of 1971. Wow. In Bodh Gaya, India. I was doing a 10-day intensive retreat with S.N. Goenka, who had just pretty recently left Burma and was starting to teach. And those were really mindfulness retreats, especially mindfulness of the body. But right at the end, he did almost a kind of ceremonial goodbye, which was loving kindness. Mm-hmm. And I was like kind of captivated. I was like, what's that? You know, I want to learn more about that. So I learned more about it, but I didn't really have a teacher to do it systematically with. So that happened for me in 1985 when I went to Burma for 3 months, and I did 3 months of loving kindness with Sayadaw Upandita. So,
wow.
And I'd sort of been playing with it before then, you know, in those intervening years, but I didn't really have guidance until I went to Burma.
So that was like the dessert for the retreat, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. Is that how loving kindness is normally taught in that tradition?
Loving kindness is considered a concentration practice. And in the time of the Buddha, often people who are not getting enlightened in 1 second, you know, with a smile or something, were given a concentration practice to do so they could spend some time like collecting their mind and stabilizing their awareness and then opening to the changing nature of things, which was more the insight part of it or the mindfulness part of it. So, and that particular concentration practice, they said, was often chosen for you by your teacher as a kind of balancing or antidote. If you had tremendous greed, for example, maybe that concentration practice would be reflecting on death or change. If you were angry or frightened, then it might be loving kindness because that's the antidote to that. They said things like the breath as a concentration practice was suitable for anybody. So it seemed to be that the most ancient of ways was that you use something like loving kindness to develop concentration, and only later did you open up to kind of choiceless awareness and the arising and passing away of all phenomena. It's also said that the Buddha taught a little described slice of Dharma, which was gladdening the mind. Like, there's so much talk about suffering and facing suffering, which of course is important and in fact essential, but the idea which really struck me right from the beginning, the idea in Buddhist teaching is not that suffering is redemptive. Like, suffering is not grace.
Yeah.
Suffering is suffering.
Yes.
And how we relate to it is all the difference. Mm-hmm. You know, and we know that just from life. Of course, there are people who suffer in some way, and they're bitter, and they're isolated, and they're hateful, and other people who suffer, and somehow they have tremendous compassion. Or they're interested in others, they're not really self-preoccupied. I mean, it's different. So it's the relationship which is really the point. And so the Buddha taught these life practices and inner practices as well to gladden the mind so that you had a more spacious, open, allowing, warm, loving kind of internal environment with which you could meet the suffering. And so that's things like generosity or morality, which make us happier.
Yeah.
So we're more buoyant. We're not going into a complex reflection, for example, feeling horrible about ourselves. You know, we're going with a sense of joy that we've made some good choices, and loving kindness fits in there.
You know, when people go and do meditation, well, I'm going to go meditate. People, well, what are you actually going to do? If you said, I'm going to spend 20 minutes gladdening the mind. That's pretty cool, right?
Yeah, it's delightful. I mean, it's not really what mindfulness is about, which is more seeing things as they are.
Yeah.
But it's a tremendous platform for mindfulness because it's not that easy to just be with things as they are. It's very easy to sink into them and get lost and feel terrible and judge yourself and feel increasingly crummy, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Which doesn't help, you know, that's not going to transform anything.
And these practices are very loving kindness and what I imagine to be gladdening the mind are very much focused on the subjective aspect. Whereas like mindfulness, or let's say breathing meditation is probably a better example, is focused on an object, or mindfulness may be focused on the content of the moment in the mind. Whereas loving kindness and maybe gladdening the mind is a little bit different because the aspect that you're interested in is the subjective mind. Can you say a little bit about that?
I'm not totally sure I understand that, because with mindfulness, you're interested in not just the object, but how are you with the object? It's all about how you're with the object. So that's the subjective mind too, right?
That's true. So like non-judgmental awareness of whatever arises. And so the whatever arises, but yeah, it's true that also you're interested in the subjective. But I guess in loving kindness, what you're really developing, developing the subjective.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like you're developing love, yeah.
I mean, I call it a stretch, you know.
A stretch.
It's like some practices are just about being closer to the truth of how things are.
Mm.
So that's the whole range of mindfulness practices or insight meditation. And some practices are more like a stretch. It's like moving from an accustomed place or an accustomed way of paying attention to a different way of paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And some people feel very squeamish about that because they think it's moving from a true place to a phony place.
Yeah.
And it's not that at all, but it's moving from a true place to another true place that maybe doesn't get a lot of airtime.
Mm-hmm.
So a common example of that would be gratitude practice. You know, many researchers and psychologists would say that it's a very healing thing for any of us to keep a gratitude journal. Like at the end of the day, just write down three things that you're grateful for from the day. And I would say, first of all, it doesn't have to be something grandiose. It could be that you're breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And I also say, as is true, it doesn't come naturally to me. You know, my personal conditioning, my familial conditioning, my cultural conditioning is so much more leaning toward getting to the end of the day and thinking what I can complain about, you know, like I didn't show up in the right way and I'm really disappointed in myself and that person didn't show up either. And there's always an airline, you know, there's always like a phone service. And that's where my mind would just go by force of habit. So it's a stretch. It takes intentionality to say, okay, what else happened today?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's not coercive and it's not diluted. I'm not trying to pretend it was just the best day ever, always, you know? But that other part doesn't usually get any airtime. So what's the good within us? You know, and it's all a stretch. Like one of the main principles of loving kindness is paying attention to those we usually ignore or look through. That's the category would be the neutral person.
Mm.
You know, someone we don't especially like or dislike, somebody maybe who plays a role in our lives, like, mm-hmm. you know, garage attendant or something.
Yeah.
And unless they've destroyed our car, you know, like, yep. they're almost more like an object to us than a person.
Yeah.
It's interesting that, you know, this stretch is like work on yourself, and like your book, Real Love, on loving kindness, starts with, you know, self-reflections, right? It starts with the work on yourself.
Yeah.
So that seems to be, to be the right place to start.
Yeah.
And so...
Yeah. Not everyone can start there, because the underlying principle is said to be doing the practice in the easiest way possible.
Mm-hmm.
And for so many people, we ourselves are not the easiest person. And I mean, it depends on the intensity of the struggle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If it's not some glorious thing, I don't mind that. You know, I think it's fine.
Yeah.
But if it's really a struggle, I think it's better to change the order and just change the sequence.
So it's true that often we're so self-critical, right? And why is that? But I was thinking of, once I thought this saying, like doing a loving kindness meditation practice, and I was thinking, loving kindness is easy, but for the humans.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I should be, loving kindness is easy, but for myself, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard to... apply these practices to ourselves sometimes. And why do you think that is the case?
Actually, before we get into that, I want to go back to your first question, because I still have something to say. So historically, one could say that doing loving kindness first as part of this progression
mm-hmm.
was the more normal thing. But in our time, my experience was I did insight practice for 14 years before mm-hmm. I did intensive loving kindness practice. It was just not available.
Mm.
And they liked that, you know, like the Burmese, for example. You know, they don't want you to get attached to good feeling. They don't want you to get lost. And it's a very relational practice. Mm. And even though it's a concentration practice, it lends itself inevitably to a lot of stories and discursive thinking. You know, you're calling real people to mind, for example. You're not asked to make a composite sketch of a homeless person.
Mm-hmm.
If you're offering loving kindness to a homeless person, you know them, or you've seen them, or you've read about them. They're actually a person. And so it's complicated, because relationships are very complicated. And so they really like you to have some amount of insight practice. I mean, for one thing, you need facility with all the negative feelings that come up,
mm-hmm.
you know, as you're doing loving kindness. It's not uncommon mm-hmm. to feel great waves of grief or anger or,
mm-hmm.
you know, all the things you don't think you would feel, but you do.
Yeah.
And so just having that experience is more, so it's more common. So I would say, so I went to Burma in 85. I did this intensive 3-month period. I came back and started teaching loving kindness right away. And I was the first person in my community who was teaching loving kindness. And it was kind of controversial, you know?
Really?
And it was a number of years. It was like a full decade before my book, Loving Kindness, came out. Yeah. But it was pretty controversial, you know?
Why so? Because you're not doing the correct order, or?
Well, people would say to me, not my closest colleagues, but people would say, you'll never see emptiness that way. It's not an insight practice. It's just a concentration practice. It's like a feel-good practice. I said to somebody the other day, I realized a lot of people were in effect saying it's a girly kind of practice.
Yeah.
You know, and which is a very interesting reflection. and it took a long time, but it was almost, I think, my first realization of the impact of it because of our conditioning, mm-hmm. you know, and how hard it is not to judge ourselves and be hypercritical, was actually, you know, like different Zen teachers would start saying to me, oh, we're reading your book, Loving Kindness. You know, like we have the chance and we have the theoretical framework, but we actually don't have the practice.
Mm.
And it's really important. And I think, oh, look at that. You know, it is the antidote. And now, of course, it's much more popular, and so I feel very gratified.
Yes, thank you. Yeah.
And when I started teaching it, this was an oversight on my part. It was just a mistake. I started teaching like an IMS. I didn't think to have a prerequisite on the retreat. Like, you must have done some mindfulness practice before you can come. So I just created like this new wave of people who started with loving kindness practice, like the very old days.
Yep.
You know, so there are any number of people who do start with loving kindness. Mm-hmm. And for some people, it's easier. Just technically, it's easier. There's a channel for your mental energy, for one thing, you know, because you're silently reciting phrases. May you be happy, may you be peaceful. And so it feels like it is a place to go. And so, you know, some people who feel a lot of energy or restlessness or agitation are, you know, like helped by that. So
different people are attracted to different types of practices, and there's a certain type of person that really relates to loving kindness as a concentration practice. How would you describe that sort of person? Someone who's got a little bit more energy, or?
Because it, I mean, there, the benefits of loving kindness practice are, first of all, loving kindness.
Yes.
You know, or as the Buddha would say, it's the antidote to fear. So it's less fear and more sense of connection.
Yeah.
You know, and also concentration.
Mm-hmm.
And in the sheer development of concentration, it is much easier for some people, not for everybody, but I think it is higher energy mm-hmm. people, because it is that way of, but even sleepy people like me, because we're working to develop both calm and tranquility and concentration mm-hmm. and energy and alertness and awareness in the practice. If the kind of calm side of things is cooking at a better rate than the energy side of things, you fall into the state classically known as sinking mind.
Mm-hmm.
I call it the ooze. You just
the ooze.
Kind of ooze along. It's very peaceful, but you're not really sharp. And then if it deepens, you fall asleep. So it's not considered a bad state because your concentration or calm, you know, that part of things is really happening. It's just out of balance, you know, so. I found that I could ooze along for a good long time with my breath, you know, and not even know it. But because you're using phrases that mean something in loving kindness, usually what happens is the phrases get garbled if you fall into that state.
Yeah.
You know, so for example, in Burma, I would hear myself repeating, may you be filled with suffering, may you be filled. And I go, no, you know, like may you be free of suffering.
I love it.
You know, like that. And so that was just the signal, and it was
that's
a good
little
feedback
like,
system.
Little monitor for you.
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
So you know, you really are largely responsible for loving kindness being popular in the West. And I was wondering the word loving kindness.
Some people might not agree with that.
Well, I can say that. And yeah. I think
certainly within my community, my tradition, yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so I was wondering the words loving kindness, because I think the Pali is metta, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering, did you get that? Did you borrow that? And there's probably many ways love and why do you think that those two words represent the practice?
Well, that was the translation that was given to me, is the common translation. And I've had many scholars and translators say to me, just say love, you know, stop being so cutesy about it, you know, just say love. And they're all problematic. Maybe all words are problematic, but certainly translations are commonly problematic. Like loving kindness, I think evokes some of that sense of, inclusion and, generosity of the spirit, but it's such an odd term. You wouldn't hear it in a casual conversation, maybe.
Yeah.
And my concern is that it might make the quality itself seem somewhat arcane and removed from day-to-day life. And love is complicated.
It's a loaded word, right?
It's a very
love
loaded
is complicated.
Word.
That's
what
true.
Do we mean when we say love? And the literal translation is friendship, but I actually have problems with that as well, because for me, friendship implies wanting to hang out together. Mm-hmm. And spend time together, let's go to the movies together or something. But one of the understandings we come to with metta, which is M-E-T-T-A, is that we might have a heart full of caring and compassion for someone, but discernment, wisdom, intelligence might say to us, you shouldn't be spending time with that person.
Yes.
You need a stronger boundary than that, or it's not safe, or it's not smart, or not now, or, you know, and that doesn't in any way denigrate the kind of purity and the force of the love. Mm-hmm. It's a whole other set of considerations. And so then I look at friendship and I think, well, yeah, maybe, but maybe not. So I just tend to say connection.
Mm. So you mentioned before that the practice is very specific. And then you're bringing up how some people in our lives can be complicated, right? And so how would you bring loving kindness meditation into your meditation with that particular, a complicated person that it might be best for you to stay away from? Should you stay away from them in your meditation, or how do you approach that as well?
No, I mean, you might want to stay away from them in your life, but not at all in your meditation, yeah, because it's a, you feel like it's a barrier to your own freedom of heart, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, so that's what I mean. It's like a whole separate consideration around what's skillful and history, and I call it your best guess, you know.
Your best guess.
Of how to act. And, yeah, you know, it's like if you're saying no to somebody, or if you're approached by somebody, should you say yes or should you say no? If you're going to say no, how fiercely?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. It depends on sensitivity and context, you know, appreciation and things like that. So tell me your question again. That's so specific.
No, actually, my question wasn't so clear, but the question is like, loving kindness practice in relationship to complicated relationships. Okay.
So one of the things I think we see is that every relationship is kind of complicated. Mm. You know, in the classical sequence, not meant to be done in a single session, you know, but over time, you're offering loving kindness to first yourself, then a benefactor, that's someone who's helped you. Where they've inspired you, they lift your spirits when you think of them. The texts say this is the one, when you think of them, you smile. Then we offer loving kindness to a friend. We offer loving kindness to a neutral person, someone we don't especially like or dislike. And this is usually somebody who plays some role in your life, so you kind of see them now and then. And then loving kindness to a difficult person. Mm. And then all beings everywhere. So, all based on the theory of doing it the easiest way possible. So it's not uncommon for people to say, well, you know, I chose this person as my benefactor. They were like my mentor. They were great. And they helped me so much. And I was offering them loving kindness and everything was going swimmingly. And then I had the memory, you know what? There was that one time when I called you and you weren't there for me. And maybe you're not my benefactor. Maybe you're my difficult person. And as the Dalai Lama would say, quoting Shantideva, friends become enemies.
Yes.
Enemies become friends. Very complex. Anyway,
conditions, yeah.
You know, so I think if you meant a difficult person, you know, someone we just feel antipathy toward or fear of or something like that. Here, too, the principle is to do it in the easiest way possible and not to start with the most, like, unthinkable person who's hurt us so badly and or is behaving or has behaved so terribly in the course of history, you know, on the world stage. To start with someone we're a little bit annoyed with, it's like strength training, you know,
strength training.
Like making our way over to someone who's more and more difficult.
Don't go to the gym and pick up the biggest weight, right?
That's right.
You're going to hurt yourself.
You're going to hurt yourself.
It's true, like what you were saying, you know, His Holiness often says, makes that point from Shantideva, and it's true. Like how many people, how many people's best friends have turned into their, like, you know, arch rival, right? And it, all because of situations, really. Mm-hmm. Just different situations. In a different situation, your best friend might not be your best friend. And then how to have love throughout situations. Mm-hmm. And it seems like this is the practice to sort of develop that type of love. And so how many hours do we have to do to get that love? How much are we doing of that to get results? How have you seen that practice affect your life?
Well, it's affected my life tremendously. I mean, I really have seen it as the antidote to fear, you know. But here too, it's a little complex question because, first of all, maybe this is true of every kind of meditation practice. It's definitely true of this one, that you are very unlikely to see the results in the formal period you have set aside to practice each day. Mm-hmm. Let's say you sit for 20 minutes a day, and even if loving kindness is your only practice, it's so unlikely that you're gonna have this huge moment, like this breakthrough moment, like, now I love myself completely, you know? And people get very disappointed because they look at that formal period and they'll often say, I don't feel very different when I sit. But they find if they look at their lives, they're very, very different. Yeah. You know, they're different with themselves when they've made a mistake, and they're more resilient. They can start again more gracefully, and they're different meeting a stranger.
Yeah.
They really pay attention in a different way, and they're different in a situation where somebody is antagonistic. You know?
Antagonism, and you mentioned fear, the relationship between this practice and fear. It's not direct for me. Can you explain the relationship between fear and this practice?
Well, if you think of loving kindness as like a generosity of the spirit,
yeah,
it's including where we might tend to exclude. It's opening to and taking an interest in rather than shutting or closing down. There's a kind of rigidity often and seeming solidity to our perceptions of someone. It's like, you know, in 1989, they gave a lecture and they were boring and I haven't really listened ever since, you know. I just know that's a boring person.
Yeah.
You know, and we do that quite a lot, or we see somebody, and it's really just a tiny fraction of their whole day, and we fix them.
Got it.
As that's not a happy person, you know, or she's always complaining or whatever it is. And both wisdom tells us that's a ridiculous way to live, you know, because everyone is always changing. And the loving kindness kind of softens that, and you feel more open and not so, you know, you just see lots of changes in your life, really quite a lot of changes in your life.
So loving kindness softens your rigidity of classifying people, right?
Yeah.
And it seems to be like an opening practice, whereas fear is like defensive and rigid.
Yeah,
I get it.
And fear is withdrawing.
Withdrawing, yep.
Compared to opening, right?
So yeah, that makes
energetically
sense.
You can kind of see how it's the opposite.
That makes sense. And so then, so for yourself or for other people doing this practice, so does it become evident over time, or is it more, is that hard to see those changes in yourself? Is it more other people you saying, oh, you've changed? How what are the indicators for good practice?
Well, usually it starts with other people saying you've changed, you know, like for some reason it seems not that easy for us to see it in ourselves, even if we're looking at our lives. And but the first real clarification is, look at your life.
Yeah.
You know, don't look at that formal period of sitting. And then you just see, like, you know, many people with stage fright, for example, students of mine who are performers, so they have to get up on that stage, tell me if they will stand there and do loving kindness meditation, things will feel very different.
Fantastic. That's great empirical evidence for the practice, right?
You know, instead of feeling like, oh, they're out there waiting to judge me, it's like, here we are together.
Yeah.
And you just have that feeling more and more, like, okay, here we are together. Oh, I made a mistake. Oh, sorry. Let me start again. You know, whatever.
Antidote to fear.
Yes, the antidote.
I remember our last conversation, you mentioned that, you know, loving kindness can be practiced anywhere, and you were trying to do it in the shopping center, waiting in line at the cash register. So what other,
that's
I wanted
great.
More, I wanted more tips from you for bringing it into the daily.
Transportation.
Yeah.
You know, every subway or bus or taxi or airplane or walking down the street. I really like walking down the street and doing loving kindness. I think it's a great time to.
And do you do it specifically to people that you're, so it's still like the practice in meditation, it's individual.
Yeah. And
so,
it's silent. Do you remember that?
That's a good key point,
that's
a good one, You know, various Western modalities like psychotherapy teach us about having a healthy attachment in relationships. And so how can we balance this with the Buddhist teachings on non-attachment?
I think in Buddhist teaching, the word attachment is used in a very, very specific way. It's not the same as in Western psychological theory where, you know, you don't want disrupted attachment, you want secure attachment. It's more, I think, in the, has more of an aura of like control. You know, we need things to be a certain way. We need a person not to change. And it's got some of the qualities of disrupted attachment and that kind of rigidity, mm-hmm. you know, lack of flexibility and so on.
Mm-hmm. Can metta practice help us be more assertive?
I think yes. I mean, the field of intentions is what's transformed in metta practice. The particular skillful action is often another kind of learning, you know, like, mm-hmm. But certainly we will be less fearful and mm-hmm. feel more connected and recognize kind of the inherent worth of everybody, you know, even if it's way covered over. Mm-hmm. I think part of what helps us be more assertive is that fearlessness. Part of it is being in touch with what we want, even, and being able to articulate it. So it's a skill. Being able to recognize the feelings that are arising that sort of start to come up and are overwhelming. Like I was thinking, like I have a friend who described herself as a person who could never say no. Mm-hmm. So that's a lack of assertion.
Yeah.
And what she did in her meditation was she started mentally imagining the kinds of situations where she was asked a question that was really, you know, a big burden, like really mm-hmm. inappropriate, but she couldn't bring herself to say mm-hmm. no. And she learned the body feeling. She learned the sensation, like the kind of panic that mm-hmm. would overcome her, like they won't love me anymore. Mm-hmm. They won't like me anymore. And she used that so that when she was at work or she was in some conversation and she was asked that very kind of question and she felt that very thing,
yeah.
that was her signal to say, I'll have to get back to you later.
Fantastic.
And she couldn't quite say no at the moment, but she could say no later.
Yep.
You know, and so we can kind of learn those patterns and not to judge ourselves, that's the loving kindness part, yeah. but to recognize that it's like a habit. Mm. And if I can catch the habit soon enough, I have options, you know, I have some choices.
Very nice. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It was really nice. I love the connection between loving kindness and fear. You know, the enlightened state is often in the text described as fearless, like Jikme.
Yeah.
And for me now, that has another dimension because that's fearless means loving now, right? Because
yeah.
the opposite of fear is love. Yeah. So if you're yeah. fearless, you're yeah. loving.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense that the enlightened state is described as fearless. Very cool. Thank you so much.
Great. You're welcome.
Next on the Wisdom Podcast, I speak with Mark Van Buren, author of A Fool's Guide to Actual Happiness, published by Wisdom. Mark is a specialist in mindful living, yoga, and meditation, and has been promoting health and wellness for over a decade.
So we have to find a way to turn towards the arising of these feelings and states of mind without getting stuck in them. And the analogy I use is the spider and the fly. I don't know so obviously, you know, a spider creates an intricate web. It's its own creation and it's very sticky. But the spider can go through it without getting stuck, whereas a fly tries to go through it and it just keeps getting caught. One arm gets caught, it tries to get the other arm out. So this is like, you know, we create this sense of self with the expectations and the ideas, and we can either be like the fly and we're always caught in it and stuck in it, or more like the spider that can kind of, you know, it knows its way around, you know. Mm. And I think meditation is becoming intimate with that web or becoming intimate with that sense of self so much that you're able to know. And you know, you have to know yourself before you can let go of yourself.